Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how is the Holocaust remembered differently in different countries? Dr. Natan Schneider is a full professor at the School of Behavioral Sciences of the Academic College of Tel Aviv Yafo in Israel. His major areas of interest and research are the Holocaust, memory, globalization, and cosmopolitanism. Dr. Schneider participated in the fourth international seminar on anti-Semitism held recently in Madrid and spoke with English Corner.
Thank you very, very much for speaking with us. You write about cosmopolitanism. Could you tell us what you mean by the term and if it's a positive concept?
Yes, definitely. I see it as a positive concept, and I develop it out of the Jewish experience between the wars and even earlier. I see cosmopolitanism, which has now become a big buzzword in sociological and political research, as grounded in what the Jews, especially in Europe, were before the catastrophe took place. And what fascinated me with that concept was that for me it was a way of rediscovering a Jewish Europe or a Europe of Jews, a way that Jews, especially after World War I, were like proactive in politics, in minority politics, cooperated with other minorities in like the Congress of European Minorities. We're fighting for the cultural rights of Jews. We're fighting for the rights of language, educational rights. But we're always constantly also cooperating with other minorities, like if German minorities outside of Germany, with Hungarian minorities outside of Hungary, with the difference that all the other minorities had mother countries, and the Jews, that was before the foundation of Israel, didn't have a mother country. But
when are you talking about? When did this take place?
Foundations of it were already laid out in the 19th century, but when it really started, when it became like a very dominant political force, was after World War I, and when the Jews appeared as Jews, as organized European Jews at the peace conference in Paris and demanded actually their rights as Jewish minority. And I find this kind of Jewish cosmopolitan politics that is a kind of the new kind of transnational politics not only historically interesting, but I find it also as something that I think could be very inspiring for Jewish politics until this very day.
So when you speak about cosmopolitanism, it's inherently Jewish.
For me, it's inherently Jewish. For a lot of my colleagues who work within the field of cosmopolitanism, they see other origins. But for me, you know, the concept is basically a Jewish concept, yes.
Something that you say, I may not have understood it correctly, but something that you say is that in the Middle East, before the decolonization, there was a kind of an inherent cosmopolitanism that seems to have disappeared with the development of the nation states after decolonization. Is that correct?
Yeah, more or less it's correct. It's not only true for the Middle East. It's correct for Europe as well. I mean, it's like the European experience in the 19th century was an imperial European experience. It wasn't an experience of nation states which needed like to define who is a member, who is not a member. If you look at the Jews in Central Europe, I mean, you could see like the Austrian-Hungarian example, where like Jews lived as subject of the Habsburg Empire, but they didn't have to define themselves as like subjects or as citizens, you know, of like after World War I, as citizens of Hungary or Romania or Poland or these countries. And in the Middle East, something very similar was going on. It was like the Ottoman Empire. And also within the Ottoman Empire, minorities could live in a way that didn't define themselves. Ethnicity was not yet a political concept. It was much more of a religious concept in those days.
So is the natural conclusion to that people lived better under the imperialist system?
It's not the imperialist system, it's the imperial system.
Okay, imperialist to some extent because, European countries that, let's say, had the power in different places in the Middle East or in Africa or wherever it was, mm-hmm. I mean, that was imperialist.
Yes, for Jews, life was different. And if it was better, if you see what happened afterwards, with the formation of nation states in Central Europe, and with the destruction of European Jewry, the imperial Jew, if you want, the Jew of the Ottoman Empire, the Jew of the Habsburg Empire, the Jew of the Russian Empire, was without a doubt better off than the Jews which lived in those same regions, in the 30s and in the 40s. That's very clear to me. But the thing is, what do you do with these concepts today? We're not here to conduct a historical seminar, and these concepts are important for me because it's that kind of Jewish minority politics, which was so prevalent during the two world wars, has disappeared. It doesn't exist anymore. And Jewish politics has basically drifted. Either it has become Zionist with the foundation of the State of Israel, and there's a very active Jewish politics which has completely changed the rules of the games. Israel is a sovereign country. It has an army. It has political institutions. It exercises sovereignty and it exercises power. And Jews are not a minority anymore. And on the other hand, you have Jewish communities in the diaspora in Europe who really don't seem to realize that and would love to see Israel still as themselves and create this kind of continuity where there is not a continuity between themselves as Jews, like in Spain, in France, and in Germany, and in all these countries, and Israel. And then they collapse these concepts like anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism as it would be the same thing. But it isn't the same thing because Israel and the Jewish experience in Israel is a different thing than the Jewish experience outside of Israel in the diaspora. And since Jews, especially in Europe, who have stopped being religious, who don't do a very proactive minority politics, have the problem that others define them of what it means to be Jewish. Like, I'm an Israeli. My Jewishness is defined by my Israeli citizenship. And my Jewishness means that I'm a member of a sovereign political community in a state which defines itself as a Jewish state. The Jew outside of Israel has a problem. If he doesn't pray in a synagogue, has stopped being an halachic Jew, and doesn't fulfill his religious obligations, what does his Jewishness or her Jewishness mean? And most Jews, especially in Europe, are, in my opinion, empty Jews. They have others fill them up in their Jewishness. What would the European Jew do without the anti-Semites? He needs the anti-Semite to define basically his Jewishness. He needs Israel to defend Israel because he has no proactive definition of what it means being Jewish. So he lets others define what it means to be Jewish, like Israel or the anti-Semites.
You talk about global or cosmopolitan values, and I was wondering what you mean by this, and if what you're saying is that there are universal values, that there are the same across cultures?
No, not necessarily so. But for me again, the Jewish angle is the more important one. And what I have written about, for instance, is human rights, which is a very important concept for me. And I have looked at the Jewish angle of human rights consciousness. As I said, after World War II and after the Holocaust, most Jewish political activists who worked in Jewish minority politics stopped being Jewish minority politicians. Many of them were killed in the Holocaust. Some of them became Zionists, and many of them left for for the United States of America. Human rights became like a new tool for Jews who, especially in the United States of America, who thought that via human rights they could start fighting anti-Semitism. So human rights is one of those concepts which is basically a transnational, I wouldn't call it universal, I would call it cosmopolitan, there's a difference. It's a transnational, cosmopolitan concept, but which has also very strong Jewish roots.
Speaking of the Holocaust, in your book, The Holocaust in Memory in the Global Age, you examine the distinctive forms that collective memory take in the age of globalization, and you show how the Holocaust is remembered differently in Israel, Germany, and the United States. How are they different, these different memories, and what is the significance of this difference?
That's a long story, but you know what happened after World War II is that what we now call the Holocaust was not seen as we see it today. It was not seen as a crime against the Jewish people. It was conceived as something in much more broader terms, as legalized or codified in legal terms as a crime against humanity. This is what we now call the Holocaust, how it was in the beginning conceptualized during the Nuremberg trials by the Allies when they indicted the Germans. What's interesting to see that during the Nuremberg trials, you don't really have a lot of mentioning of the crimes against the Jews as a crime against the Jews. It was a universal crime. In Israel, of course, I mean, this crime could not be interpreted as a universal crime, but was from the beginning conceived as a crime against the Jewish people. So what you had is, like, right from the beginning, 1945, 1946, 1947, you have these like two different forms of perception of what happened during those years. For the world, what happened was an awful crime against humanity, and the victims happened to be Jewish, but there were also other victims. For Israelis and for Israeli Jews, and not only for Israeli Jews, but for the Jews themselves, the crime was basically remembered as a crime against the Jewish people. It was a particular crime, a specific crime. So what you have is you have like a Western universal memory of the Holocaust, and you have a particular Jewish memory of the Holocaust, and they didn't meet in the beginning. Nuremberg is really a good example, the Nuremberg trials. They didn't meet. The Nuremberg trials then were responsible for the codification of international law. Then you have the UN Declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is very clearly referring back to the Holocaust without mentioning it. They talk about barbarous acts which outrage the conscience of mankind. And in 1948, everybody knew what was meant by these barbarous acts which outrage the conscience of mankind. But the word Jew is not mentioned. But if you look at all the paragraphs of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, what you see is like the countermeasures against Nazism. Everybody has a right to live. Everybody has the right to security. Marriage should be universal. Sort of, it was like almost taking like the Nazi way of thinking and reversing it.
But do you think that they did this and did not mention the Jews because they wanted it to be more universal?
There were many Jews, very many, many Jews active in the codification of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Not only Jews, but many Jews, especially many Jews who were working out of the United States. For them, for Jewish politics after World War II, it was extremely important to start looking at the dangers against the Jews in terms of universalism. It was very, very, very important for them. I've seen, you know, very important statements in the archives of people of the World Jewish Congress and in the Institute of Jewish Affairs and activists of Jewish politics who declared that the concept of human rights will be the major tool of the fight against anti-Semitism. This will protect us. This was one Jewish answer to it. The other Jewish answer, of course, was the foundation of the State of Israel,
and its self-declaration that only a sovereign state of the Jews can protect the Jews. And here you have sort of like a kind of like separation between two kinds of memories. That kind of memory which used the concept of human rights has then traveled even further out and has completely disconnected from the Holocaust. It has so much disconnected from the Holocaust that actually the former victims of the Holocaust are now being considered the major perpetrators of the violation of human rights. And if the former victims of the Holocaust have become the major perpetrator of the violation of human rights, then of course you have like the identification of Israeli Jews with Nazis, which comes very easily, and all that. But it had to do the way through the human rights consciousness, sort of like this is what you could see in Israel, like a couple of years ago, very clearly, was the debate regarding the Goldstone Report. And a lot of people in Israel couldn't understand how Goldstone, a Jew, how could he do this to us? Because Goldstone, who is a declared Zionist, whose daughter lives in Israel, who is an active member of a Jewish community in South Africa, a proud Jew as they come, as one would say, he considered himself being in the tradition of a Jewish human rights politics. And, you know, it's no coincidence that in the United States, when you look at Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and all the human rights organizations, that you have a disproportionate number of young Jews very active in the human rights community. They see themselves as Jews. This is part of what it means for them to do Jewish politics. It's now human rights politics. Whereas the Israeli perspective has traveled into a different direction. So what I try to do in the book is to show sort of like how different structures of memory has arisen out of the Holocaust and have traveled into different directions, sometimes meet, sometimes converge.
Something else that you say is you talk about the impact of human rights principles and normative cosmopolitanism on both the nation state and on international relations. What responsibility do individual countries have with regard to human rights violations in other countries? Mm-hmm.
This is exactly that. What does human rights consciousness mean? And again, this principle was established in Nuremberg. When you look at what it says about crimes against humanity, it says quite clearly that it defines the crimes against the civilian population. It could be the population of your own country, et cetera, et cetera. But what it also declares is that the fact that it is state law, and the fact that you have received orders to perpetrate these acts doesn't release you from responsibility.
As an individual.
As an individual and as a member of your own community. That means, basically, that the Nuremberg Principle, which was then codified in international law, basically claims that international law is stronger than national law, which means that basically it means that there are no internal affairs anymore. That everybody has the right to intervene in the affairs of other states. And, I mean, as you know better than anyone else, I mean, this already started actually before World War II in Spain with the international brigades. I mean, this was one of the first examples that there was like a leftist politics which thought that Spain or that Spanish leftists needed to be rescued from a revolt within the country and sent troops.
Yeah, but those weren't countries that sent troops to intervene in
exactly.
Spain.
At least not
on the human rights side.
No, of course not. These were volunteers. But the idea that you can travel to another country and fight for one side in that country against the other side of the country was a clear violation of sovereignty. And then later on, all what we have today, when it comes to humanitarian interventionism, that means that you can undermine the sovereignty of nation states in the name of human rights.
Bosnia.
Bosnia is like one of the clearest examples in modern European politics. And, you know, in other states, and we have lots of examples, and, you know, there are a lot of people who are against this because they still believe in the sovereignty of nations and, you know, not in interventionism. But it all started, you know, with the way that politics was conceived in the shadow of the Holocaust.
However, can one be a little suspicious sometimes of the motives behind interventionism, because a country or an international organization such as NATO can say, well, we're intervening because this country is violating human rights, but then you kind of wonder, well, you know, what do they really want? Do they really want economic power? Do they really want the oil? I mean, there's this kind of suspicion behind that a little bit. Are they really, really trying to implant human rights?
I mean, of course you should be suspicious. There's no doubt about it, because, I mean, there's a tension built in this, because human rights is basically, it's taking the high moral ground. It's a moral principle. You know, you shall not kill. You know, it's almost like religion coming to the earth. You know, it's like it's a high moral principle. You should intervene to save other people from savagery and all that. But you can only exercise this kind of high moral principle through force and violence and power. So humanitarian interventionism is a very strange coalition between high morality and power politics. And, you know, then you have people who are against it and said, yeah, but the powers only intervene there, but they don't intervene here. And this is part of the struggle. You have to take your side in this game. It's also that you cannot stand anymore outside of it. You can say you don't want to intervene, you want to intervene, but it becomes part of a general international debate. And this is what really has changed. And clearly, there's absolutely no way you can think of humanitarian interventionism without power politics. And you need an army to intervene, and you need a strong power to intervene, and not many armies can do this. So, of course, you have like powers like America and the UK and other countries who are able to do this intervene. So what you have is you have the German army soldiers fighting in Afghanistan, and all of a sudden you have like soldiers who are not only defending their own homeland and their own country, but what you have is like people going to all kinds of places and fighting. And, you know, one can be for it, one can be against it, but it's clear that you have to take a position. And this is not about the church. This is about politics, and it's about power politics. So, of course, I mean, what you ask, if you can trust the motives, is like already taking a position that says, I'm only for humanitarian interventionism and the motives are pure, if they're authentic. You know, if it's about power or money or resources or oil or influence, then the motives are not pure anymore, then I'm against it. This is a position that a lot of people take. I mean, that's a position that is also has become a kind of leftist position. You know, it's like only when the motives are pure, I'm for it. But there are no pure motives in that game. It's always a mixture of power and morality.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. I'll leave you now with After You've Gone by Woody Allen from his album Wild Man Blues. See you next week.